If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, do it Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Today is officially the first day of spring. Did I sleep through winter? Enjoy! Here's Scott Thompson!
There you go. Live today.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML.
Lots going on today. Pierre Poilievre is going to push the House of Commons for a non-confidence motion to axe the tax, the carbon tax. It's now a payment. It's gone from a tax to a payment. Anyway, that has no chance of happening because the Liberals and the NDP have merged to form a majority. So largely politics and grandstanding and driving point the home about how we're all feeling right now. As we find out, a federal government consultants, contractors fraudulently billing taxpayers. Nobody knows what's going on, left hand or the right hand. Three cases in front of the RCMP now to look at all of that. And something fascinating, I was watching CTV last night, and they had an interesting interview with Thomas Mulcair, who is the former leader of the NDP. And I don't know if you know the whole situation regarding the vote that was held yesterday. It's pretty deep into the political weeds, but the NDP brought forward a motion to recognize Palestine as a state, liberals, I think about three liberals voted against this. The rest did. Conservatives, of course, voted against this. And what eventually ended up happening was they got a watered down version, and instead of recognizing a Palestinian state, instead they voted to actively pursue. That's the words, the term, a two-state solution with a Palestinian state. So not much different than what we already had, but still, for some reason, a very divisive line drawn in the sand in the House of Commons. And you wonder why Canada is becoming such a divided country. So as I'm watching this interview last night, I found it astounding. Thomas Mulcair, who I think was one of the, you know, the better NDP leaders, along with Jack Layton, who really seemed to at least resonate with mainstream Canada and those towards the center as opposed to the extreme left. He made comments yesterday that in regard to this vote and this grandstanding that went on for hours in the House of Commons is another example of the slow radicalization of the NDP. And he said that this isn't his old NDP or even that of Jack Layton's, that this is a more radical position than any of those two leaders would take. So incredible words from the former leader of the NDP party. And here's an excerpt of what he had to say about this vote that happened yesterday, which is non-binding. It's all symbolic, but still divides Canada in two.
There will be a price to pay for it, but it's because they're simply going to be seen to have been in lockstep with the NDP that had a far more radical position. One, by the way, Vashi, that you know, that neither Jack Layton nor I would have ever approved of. But that's been the slow radicalization of the NDP on the Israel-Palestine file. It was very one-sided, what was put forward. I am surprised to learn that Liberals applauded Heather McPherson for that very one-sided approach. But I guess that's going to be part of the rest of the discussion about what happens from now on.
All right. So fascinating. Fascinating admission from Thomas Mulcair, former leader of the NDP, that he called it the slow radicalization of the NDP on this, and it's certainly not. And of course, any time a new leader takes the party, many are looking at the Liberals and saying, you know, what Trudeau or what Trump has done to the Republicans or what have you. Obviously, the leader is going to change the tone of any party, but to change the ideology or take the ideology to the extreme, which is what we've seen with the NDP and even Justin Trudeau's Liberals, as he's taken the once great left of center party and taken taken it to the extreme left, and now has not only divided Canadians, but dividing his own party as well. And to the point where, you know, Thomas Mulcair, former leader of the NDP, in commentary says, and that's not the same party I was in, and neither that of Jack Layton, who many would say was probably the most successful and popular NDP leaders. Maybe you would debate that now with Jagmeet Singh and the leverage he has used with the deal with the Liberals and the NDP to leverage at least the discussion on pharmacare. We're certainly no closer to it. And the same with dental care. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this all comes about and if we can bring this country back to the center, right or left, as opposed to the extremes, which really is just dividing. And it doesn't matter if you're on the extreme left or the extreme right. It's populist politics. It's all populist politics. It's not just the right. It's the extreme left as well. And that's what we're seeing. And it's unfortunate. It's the Canada we've become, with one of the most divisive prime ministers in certainly my history. So but we'll see where that goes. And hopefully, again, we can get politics back into the center realm, whether it's left or right, where the majority of Canadians really are. They're not on the fringes with the extremes, who really have the attention of everyone right now. The Prime Minister, former Prime Minister, lying in state until today, and then has just recently left the House of Commons, the Parliament Hill, and moving on to Montreal for tomorrow and Friday, and then again the funeral on Saturday. To talk a little bit about the legacy of Brian Mulroney, Nelson Wiseman is with us, Professor, Department of Political Science, University of Toronto, and here now. Nelson, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm well, Scott. Thank you.
Nelson, your thoughts on some of the tributes we've been hearing. I'm not sure if we wouldn't hear this about any leader who had just passed away, but it seems interesting to hear the tributes from either side of the political spectrum. And maybe that's just the divisive politics that we find ourselves in now. But are you surprised about some of the tributes you're hearing and we're seeing come in?
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, Mulroney was prime minister at a very pivotal moment in Canada's development. Of course, when someone dies, a political leader, and generally eulogies are very positive. You speak to the positive characteristics of the person who passed away, and then you often look at what they accomplished, and you think that, well, now that death redeems leadership. So when Mulroney left, he was incredibly, incredibly unpopular. In fact, his standing in the polls was flirting with the same same level of interest rates in the country. But when you look back at what happened during his years in power, first, he was very popular, and major changes took place. The free trade agreement with the United States, which the Liberals and the NDP fought tooth and nail. And now, of course, everybody wants to keep it and is terrified that it would be ripped up. Mulroney also acted on acid rain. A green organization in Canada dubbed him the greenest prime minister in Canada's history. Mm. And historians, from something I read today, suggest he was one of the five most important prime ministers we've had. So, and mind you, along the way, he had some reversals as well, like trying to change the Constitution with the Meech Lake Accord and the Charlottetown referendum. But leading up to them, he had secured a consensus among all the premiers and the other parties in the House of Commons, which was something you can't imagine happening now.
What is the difference in politics of that era and where we find ourselves now?
Well, we didn't have social media then.
Yeah.
And so social media has changed the whole landscape of reality. It sows division, discord, and presents alternative views of reality. Back in that day, you had fewer news sources. There are a lot of people now who don't subscribe to anything except social media feeds. Well, anybody can put anything they want on social media, and anybody can believe whatever they want. But all views aren't equal. So at that time, you had more responsible reporting. And you also had a herd instinct among journalists. So if the Globe and Mail led with a story or an editorial, a lot of other journalists thought, oh, well, these people are better informed. And they followed along with that line. In fact, that's actually what killed the Progressive Conservative Party in the election in 1993. Kim Campbell had taken over from Mulroney, who was very unpopular and knew his time had passed. We're not seeing that right now with Justin Trudeau, though, who's going to suffer the same fate if he hangs in. So Mulroney was wise enough to leave and not get defeated. But he had accomplished a lot. And some of the things he put in were very unpopular, like the GST. But in retrospect, where would our finances be of the country without the GST?
How do leaders in this environment, in this new world, unite as opposed to divide? Is that impossible now, Nelson? We saw with Aaron O'Toole, he tried to bring everything back to the center, and what happened to him. So are we now, as the fringes have been exposed, more divisive? Is there something, how do leaders bring us back together, unite us?
Well, first off, about Aaron O'Toole, about you describing him as a centrist. Well, he was in the Conservative Party, but that's not how he was presented by the Liberals or the NDP. Hmm. You know, they argued, oh, you know, women will never get an abortion in Canada again, and, you know, we'll have rampant privatization and so on. No, the prospects for dampening divisiveness is bleak, but it is possible that you will have consensus if people feel there's an existential threat to the country, or there's a crisis of such proportions that alternative realities just don't explain, you know, nobody goes for them. But most of politics is just the day-to-day grind of common public policy. So what we're getting now is going to continue. The U.S. shows us its future. There's high levels of polarization there. And what we notice is that high levels of political polarization or levels are increasing in Canada as well, because we are probably more influenced by the U.S. than any other country in the world.
Nelson Wiseman with us, professor, Department of Political Science, University of Toronto, legacy of Brian Mulroney, politics then and now. Nelson, as always, thanks so much for your time. Be well.
Thank you.
A very bizarre day in the House of Commons yesterday, and many are still trying to figure out exactly what it was all about, other than, of course, more divisiveness. Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly says the federal government will stop sending arms to Israel. What is changing? And anyway, we'll leave it at that. Dr. Jack Cunningham with his PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto, here now. Jack, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Hope you are, too.
First of all, what do we send to Israel? Do we send arms or many arms, weaponry, whatever you want to call it, to Israel?
Well, we do, at least until very recently. I gather that since January, that has been on hold pending the occasional review for human rights implications that is applied to all Canadian arms sales abroad. But this motion does provide a reason for the government to continue that. Minister Joly said, first of all, that an opposition motion cannot dictate changes in Canadian foreign policy. But she then subsequently said, after the motion was passed, that policy will be formulated with the spirit of the resolution in mind. So that does open up the possibility of an ongoing halt in arms supplies to Israel. I think that's a problem. The analogy that occurs to me is if in 1940, when Britain was basically alone in resisting Hitler, we had suspended military assistance to Britain, it would look pretty awful with the benefit of hindsight. I think this may look very much the same, given the given enough time to pass.
Are you surprised it has come to this in the House of Commons?
Not as much as some. I mean, to some extent, one of the problems in a minority government, particularly when you have the sort of agreement the Liberals have with the NDP, is that the tail easily wags the dog. And the junior partner often extorts pretty substantial concessions from the senior one just to keep its support. I think that's part of what's happened here. Now, the process by which the resolution, the motion was passed left a lot to be desired. The last minute changes, obviously a mockery of traditional parliamentary process, but it reflects the rather frantic effort of the government to come up with somebody that something that almost everybody could agree to. Now, obviously, they were not altogether successful. The Conservatives voted against the motion. So did three brave and principled Liberals. But everybody else went along. And I think it's reflective of the pattern of the government's behavior on this issue, trying to please everybody.
Wow. We hear so much about our depleted military. I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is, do we send really anything significant to them to stop sending them, or is this highly symbolic?
It is in part symbolic, but symbolism counts. The more that others are seen as reluctant to aid Israel, the worse the light in which Israel appears internationally. And when that happens, it is something of a reward to Hamas and those of like mind. They get the impression that resorting to violence will pay off for you. And that also applies in the case of the another feature of this motion, the one that urges a resumption of progress towards a negotiated two-state solution. The more international pressure that is placed on Israel to negotiate such a solution and perhaps to make concessions in order to get it, the more it creates the impression that resorting to violence, particularly in the context of October 7th and of the current conflict, actually works. That if you resort to violence, you will get others to up the pressure on Israel. And that is not, I think, a message we should be eager to send.
Are we dealing with Israel differently than we are Ukraine?
Yes, we are. One of the things that really strikes me is how a lot of people who see with a fair amount of moral clarity what's going on in Ukraine don't see the same thing in the context of Israel, which is rather surprising in some ways, because the way I look at it, they are actually separate theaters of the same fundamental struggle. I mean, increasingly, we have a geopolitical polarization of the world. The Western liberal democracies on one side, and on the other, the aggressive revisionist powers led by Russia and China, but with regional proxies like Iran and regional tools like Hamas, whom they will encourage to create regional problems when it's convenient and when they have the opportunity.
Can Palestinians separate themselves from Hamas?
Well, we have seen polling data from both the West Bank and Gaza, actually from before the October 7th attacks, and they showed that support for Hamas was by no means inconsiderable. There was the most popular option for the future settlement of the region was Palestinian reconquest of all of mandatory Palestine, a binational solution with a single state solution with both Jews and Arabs living together was a second choice, but a genuine coexistence with two states was pretty far behind. So there is a lot of support among Palestinians for Hamas that has grown. And I think it not only makes negotiations difficult, it raises the question of whether there is, at the moment, a negotiating partner among the Palestinians with whom we can do productive business.
Wouldn't that change everything? I mean, is that not the sticking block? And, you know, I mean, for many, this isn't about Palestinians versus Israelis. It's about terrorism versus democracy. If they were to separate themselves from Hamas, would that not make this a lot easier? The problem is,
it's a lot easier. But the only alternative to Hamas in the disputed territories is Fatah, which controls a Palestinian Authority running the West Bank. And Fatah is actually not a lot better than Hamas. It is not openly genocidal. It talks peace when it's talking to the West, but to its own people, it talks about any Palestinian state as merely being the first stage in the gradual reconquest in phases of all of mandatory Palestine. And that's why people who have experience in Israel frequently refer to the Palestinian Authority as Hamas in suits. So there's not a plausible partner there either.
Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto. Always fascinating, Jack. Thank you for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
Citing escalating security concerns, the Playhouse Cinema says it has had to postpone an upcoming film festival organized by the Hamilton Jewish Federation, calling the decision difficult and apologizing to ticket holders. The movie theater has hosted several film festivals over the last 3 years, but there's issues here around security. To find out what is going on in our Canada, Jasmine Rimberg with us, communications coordinator, Hamilton Jewish Federation, and here now. Jasmine, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for getting in touch.
Jasmine, what happened here? How did this go off the rails?
Well, you know, over the weekend, we received some emails from the theater, you know, expressing concerns over these letters that they received, these baseless accusations calling any film coming from Israel a Zionist propaganda. And I think that their security concerns, you know, I think it's worth noting that as we do for all of our events, we had taken proactive measures to ensure the safety of all attendees and anyone working in the theater.
What sort of proactive measures?
Well, we always make sure we have police presence.
Yeah. Have police been notified about this?
You know, we throughout since October 7th and even before that, we have worked very closely with police and we have been in touch.
What is their reaction?
You know, I can't really speak on that right now, but you know, they're supportive and they, up to this point, they've never told us to cancel an event. So we are moving forward with the film festival and we are going to be holding it at our venue.
So, did they say what the threats were or what the security issues were? Could they were specific in any way?
The main concerns were that these films that were made in Israel. There were some films made in Israel. So the whole film festival has Jewish films from Poland, France, and Israel. Of course, the main concern being the films that were created in Israel are labeled as a form of Zionist propaganda, which is inaccurate.
And how does the Playhouse react to this? Are they caught in the middle? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that their decision to cancel the festival, especially considering their recent screenings of films such as The Zone of Interest and One Life, both of which are centered around the Holocaust, I think their decision, it's pretty ironic, I would say.
And you said this film festival will go ahead anyway.
Yes. So while the Playhouse decided to cancel it, we have decided that we're actually going to be postponing it and we will be hosting it at our newly renovated facility later.
And when is that? So any date there yet?
We are still working out our schedule, but it's definitely going to be happening later this spring, either end of May or something like that.
And are you
community updated?
And are you worried or expecting security issues?
You know, like with every event that we host, we have to take security measures. And this is before October 7th. We always take extra precautions and we're going to have police presence like we do at all of our events.
Who is protesting this, Jasmine?
So the all the complaints that we heard are anonymous, that we received from the theater. They are anonymous, so I can't disclose that.
Has this sort of thing escalated since the Hamas-Israeli war began?
You know, absolutely. People will protest different events. They will either comment on social media, and their comments are always, you know, saying that we are promoting Zionist ideology and everything. And it's really just blatant anti-Semitism that we've received.
How do you process all of this? Are you surprised at this reaction? Are you surprised that this protest or protesting has turned to this? Because, again, we know Canada's a free country. You can protest what you want. But it seems to be there's lines being crossed here.
I think there's definitely a double standard here. And unfortunately, what's unfolded here is very much in keeping with my expectations. I'm still shocked, and I'm very disturbed, and I think we all are. And what I've been hearing from our, you know, affiliated community is that we're all deeply disturbed by what's happened here. But again, I can't say anyone is really that surprised.
What about reaction, whether within or outside the Jewish community? What's the reaction that you have to go through this?
Well, we have our allies outside of the Jewish community, and they've been very supportive. Yeah.
So what happens next? You regroup and then find out dates and such in which to present this film festival on your own grounds, on your own property.
Absolutely. We're committed to the film festival's mission, and I want to stress the importance of community support and unity, and the festival will go on. As they say, the show must go on, and we will be moving forward.
Good for you. Have you heard the threats that the Playhouse has received?
I did read them, and it's really, again, it's quite disturbing that people just feel, I mean, it's created a, I think what's happened the past few months, it's just been easier for people to express their anti-Semitism and to express their anti-Israel sentiment. That's really it. It's really hard to come to terms with it, but that's what it's come to.
All right. The Hamilton Jewish Federation Film Festival will go ahead. Dates to be announced. Jasmine Rimberg with us, Communications Coordinator, Hamilton Jewish Federation. Good luck, Jasmine.
Thank you very much. Thanks for calling.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
As if it isn't bad enough, like, you know, we're getting another carbon tax increase coming up on April 1st. It's also tax time. Oh, my goodness. It just doesn't get any better than that. And it's this guy, one of this guy's busiest times of the year, avoiding a CRA audit and navigating new tax rules. Let's bring in Don Fox, Executive Financial Consultant, Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management. Make sure you're listening to us on Planning Your Financial Future every Saturday morning. Don, I hope you're doing well.
Doing fantastic. Scott, yourself?
So far, so good. I don't do my own taxes because I can't add. Do many people still do their own? I mean, I know there's lots of great programs out there. You can do it. Is there a lot of do-it-yourselfers?
Actually, there still is. There's still a lot. It's just that they don't do it by paper. And there is the odd, you know, one that still likes the challenge of that. It's almost like doing a crossword puzzle, if you ask me. But the programs are really easy. You can put in it, you know, for the average person, they work someplace, maybe have some investment, maybe an RSP slip. It is not that difficult. And you can even actually, there's some net filing ways, and you can actually get through it, navigate it if you want. And it's not that hard. But for those that are a little more complicated, that's where you want to deal with a tax preparer or an accountant, or if you simply want to hit the easy button, that's the other reason to do it.
Also, you know, I mean, you might be scared you miss something. I mean, I guess the average person is the average person, but I'd be scared that I wouldn't do something or cross a T or dot an I that would get us something.
Yeah, good point. You know, you got so many different things that they change every year, too. So it's not that, you know, just because you nailed it last year doesn't mean you're going to get it right this year. And a good example would be, you know, during COVID, they allowed people to stay at home, and you got a deduction for home office expense that was, you know, a simplified version, and it was a $5 per day you stayed at the office or your house to a maximum, I believe it was $500. this year they've gone away from that, and you're back to the old system where you need to have your employer sign a T-2200, and you get to write off, you know, basically the, you know, square footage of your office or based on rooms of the house. So back to the old way. I kind of like the you know, the way it was during the pandemic. It, to the most part, it made sense and really didn't make that much of a difference when people tried both ways. But anyway, you got to go with the flow.
Is that the biggest change this year compared to this year to last year?
That's a good question. There's a few other changes that come to mind, but the one that seems to be popping its head recently would be that new bear trust return that people have to do. And it's basically, it's not really more of a tax hit as much as an information hit. So if you were to say, are joint owner on a bank account with your mother or father that are elderly, for example, and you're helping them pay their bills and so forth, and there's over $50,000 in the account, you now have to fill in a trust tax return, and it's supposed to be filled in by April the 2nd this year. It's usually April the 1st, but it happens to fall on a weekend. They are going to waive the penalties this year because this is a brand new remittance that has to be done, and the penalties are quite heavy. It's usually, the penalties are $25 a day for every day you're late, to a minimum of $100 and to a maximum of $2,500. And so this year, they know it's the first year. And I was just literally on the phone with somebody. We're just talking about this. And I know it's also, we'll be chatting about it coming up this Saturday on the show. But yeah, it's an annoyance. And I'm not quite sure the reasoning. I guess it's to try to catch the ones that are blatantly trying to avoid tax. But that's only, you know, 99% of the people are doing things correctly. And they got to fill in a lot of paperwork this year. You got to, first of all, the first thing you need to do is get a trust number. So go to MyCRA and go through how to get this done, or speak to your accountant. But I know they are overwhelmed. I spoke to an accountant earlier this week, and they say, yes, this is priority number one right now, are these trust tax returns.
And this is to anybody who would, say, be responsible for their elderly parents' accounts. Why would they be going after the person that's doing that? And you said this is for more information?
Yeah, it's more information grab. The other side is a minor. So you have maybe with your child and you're a joint owner for them. The other one they catch you is if you jointly hold a mortgage or so you co-signed a mortgage on somebody's, on your son or daughter's house. And that was the only way they could get a mortgage, or it helped them get a better rate. And you have no ownership in it. You're not on the deed. You're simply on the mortgage. Well, they deem there's a 1% ownership now. And now you have to fill in this trust tax return, or sorry, trust return. And it's ownersome. And it's one of those things that so many people are getting caught up on this web. I'm not sure if the government really thought this through of all the people that are going to be caught with this, and maybe they will make changes, but this year does not apply. And I would definitely, for everybody in the situation where you have joint ownership with a non-spouse, that's the key. If it's with your spouse, no problem at all. But mm-hmm. if it's with a child or an uncle or your mother, dad, or co-sign on any asset that is a non-spouse, you have to fill in this trust agreement. And this is what they call a bare trust, because you actually don't get any benefit from this. Your name's simply on it. So you're not getting any, you're not living in the house. You're not getting the interest on the investment. You're not getting any rent, for example. You can't sell it. You there's no benefit to you. You're simply, your name's on it.
Right.
And now you have to fill in this trust return.
All right, Don Fox with his executive financial consultant, Fox Group IG Private Wealth Management. More on this coming up Saturday morning on planning your financial future, navigating the new tax rules. Don, thanks for the time. We'll chat Saturday.
You bet. Anytime, Scott. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
TELUS Health sells health services to organizations, including employee assistant programs, mental health platforms, that sort of thing. And their latest TELUS Health Mental Health Index has been released. That's surveying people employed in Canada, the U.S., United Kingdom, Europe, Australia, New Zealand. And TELUS Health says it has found that more Canadian workers under the age of 40 reported feeling isolated and lonely than their older colleagues. 45% under 40 said they did not have trusted workplace relationships, and that the lack of trusted relationships is a factor in loneliness. To talk more about all of this and what it all means moving forward in the workplace, Paula Allen is with us, global leader, research and client insights, vice president at TELUS Health. And here now, Paula, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So this is fascinating, and it's an interesting gauge because you've gauged employees that are all over various parts of the world. What do we define, or what did they or you define as a trusted relationship?
It's one where you could be yourself, where you have that sense of safety, where you feel support, where you have a sense of belonging when you're with the other party. It really is what feeds us as human beings. And it's not surprising that it's so strongly correlated with isolation, because if we don't have that sense of trust and social support, then we end up actually having increased anxiety just because of how we're built as human beings. And that definitely impacts our mental health.
Why the younger demographic? Why those under 40?
Well, very, very unfortunately, we've been trending towards increased isolation as a society for decades. So as we sort of, you know, develop and we become more able to do things by ourselves from a practical sense, we slip into behaviors where we do things by ourselves because we're able to. The other thing is that because there is so much information flow and so many ways to actually spread information, we started to become a little bit less trusting of others in terms of holding that personal information. So we've been trending like this, and believe me, it's impacting all of us. It's just that when you're younger, this is all that you've known. You know, the intensity that we're feeling right now is what people are born into. And the subsequent generation, if we don't sort of, you know, take hold of this, will probably have this impact them even more.
Is this just the result of social media plus a global pandemic?
Well, I'll answer the pandemic question first. The pandemic made things a little bit worse, but it certainly didn't start this. Like this, this trend towards isolation had been happening, you know, globally for several decades. But what the pandemic did is it introduced intensity of isolation, which actually made some health conditions, some mental health conditions, worse. So there's certain conditions, many conditions actually, that isolation actually significantly exacerbates the symptoms and the distress. The other thing that isolation does is it makes us less resilient to stress. Social support is really one of the best counters to stress. But what we're also seeing right now is that people started to behave in different ways, and two-thirds of us actually have less social interaction now than we did before because we just got used to less social interaction. So that's one thing. And from a social media point of view, I know that there's, you know, a lot of reasons why people are concerned about social media, but it's not the entire thing. You know, it is an exacerbating factor. It does lead to that kind of anxiety about losing control of your information. But there's many other factors in society that have led to this as well.
At the end of the day, we need relationships. We got to get out.
100% As human beings, think about it, you know, for centuries, if we didn't have a tribe, a community, a group, we died. You know, you weren't able to live, you know, have food, counter the environment if you didn't have other people around you. So anthropologically, we're built to need other people, and we still need other people. As I said, Social support is the best counter to stress, and isolation impacts your mental health, but actually it's so straining on you, it also impacts your physical health. You're more likely to have cardiovascular conditions, you're more likely to have several conditions, and actually a shorter lifespan as well.
I've told this anecdote a couple of times. I remember, and it must have been, oh my goodness, 15 years ago, 20 years ago now, my kids were younger. We're sitting at a table, and I'm looking over at a family of about 12 all sitting at the table, and they were all talking on their devices. And I remember at that point how strange it seemed. Now yeah. It is the norm. How do we fix that? Because as you mentioned, it's not just the pandemic. It's not just social media. We were heading in that direction anyway. How do we back out of this? Or are we going to see the pendulum swing back when we just realize, as you're suggesting, we need to make contact?
Well, realizing it is actually one of the first steps. We know now, that, even though we have cars and machines, that it's important to take care of our physical health by getting activity. So we're intentional about that now, or we at least should be. The same thing in terms of our mental health and well-being. And one of the cornerstones is that social connection, shared experiences. So when you reach out to others, you get that kind of support back. So I do think that we can be active in changing this pattern. But we also need to have a little bit more patience. Because one of the things that we find is that people are less patient in developing relationships, and it takes time to develop trust. You could have a single interaction, but you need to have, more interactions, see people in different situations. You need to allow that to develop, as opposed to saying, well, this person is in this category, and I'm going to move to somebody else who might be closer on my list.
Also, during the pandemic, we realized, I think, what was important to us, what we want, what we don't want. And, and maybe that's the same with relationships. Not my circus, not my monkey. I don't need this. We pushed relationships away. How do we find that balance?
Well, I don't think it's the volume of relationships. Actually, I know it's not the volume of relationships. People can have many, many social interactions, and they still are very isolated. They still have the negative physical and mental health impacts of loneliness. It's the quality of those relationships. So knowing what you want and knowing who you trust and making sure that you have a good circle around you, I'm all for that. It's just that when we don't give ourselves the opportunity for that, we're giving ourselves more opportunity for damage.
All right. Get outside, more face-to-face time. Paula Allen with us, global leader, research and client insights, and vice president at TELUS Health. Those under the age of 40 feeling lonely and isolated. Paula, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
My pleasure. Take care.
Iroquois Ridge Secondary School in Oakville is set to be renamed after the Halton District School Board deemed the term Iroquois to be offensive following an anonymous complaint, but Indigenous elders say they were not consulted on this. To talk more about it all, Jody Harbour with us, the co-founder of Grandmother's Voice, an Indigenous cultural organization in Oakville and here now. Jody, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, Scano. Thank you. I'm well.
Jody, I'm doing well too. Thanks so much. Jody, give us some education here. What can you tell us about the term Iroquois as an Iroquois Ridge? Is this an offensive term?
Well, not from where I'm from. I'm Haudenosaunee. I found out through my healing journey, finding out more about my culture. I always knew I was Indigenous, but growing up, I identified as Iroquois because that's all my father knew. So when I moved into this area, one day, well, that term woke is so out there right now, but I guess you could say that like 15 years ago, I was like, wow, look at this, Iroquois Ridge, my son's going to go to that school, and Iroquois Shore. So I was like, wow. And then it brought me to do more learning and research, and that's what I got connected to the principal that named it. I did research at University of Toronto. And it put me into this journey of wanting to know more. And then I realized there was not a lot of, there was not a lot of work happening or connection, community building here. And that's what Grandmother's Voice came from as well, was this whole, I want to know more. What's Iroquois and what does it mean? And so I got to learn about, how to identify myself as a Cayuga, Six Nations, Haudenosaunee woman. And that's my, and so how it, what the principal explained to me is that this was the name Iroquois Ridge came from Lake Iroquois that actually existed here and was, became, was a water, like a water that was, and I guess it ended at where the school sits today. So it was after the Ice Age, and there's some great history to here, and it's like 14,000 years ago. So that's just, you know, what I know, but you can do research.
So in your mind, as a member of the community, does it pay tribute? You seemed like you were enlightened to hear and see those names, or does it insult the Indigenous community?
Well, I think I shared my message with a reporter, and everyone is on their own journey. But what I know, right. And their understanding is different. So I think what I've learned the most on my journey of learning about my Indigenous culture, or the understanding is we have this opportunity in life to look at things from, you know, our own perspectives, but really, is it a good perspective? Is it negative? And everything that I've learned from my culture, my elders, the teachings, everything that was left out of our society was that Indigenous people we understand that life is full of adversities, and it's about living as harmoniously as we can, like nature does, like we just deal with it. You know that there's going to be bad days and good days. And so I think that's all it is we don't, this word goes back so far in history. So, you know,
In your mind, Jody, seeing that name up there on the high school or the street, as you made reference to, does that in your mind pay tribute and generate that discussion that we need, as opposed to removing it?
Definitely. I think it is a tribute to what was here before. I think that it's about the community itself has just created this beautiful essence around this idea that, you know, just there was something here before us, and it reminds us that people lived here and history has happened. And now what's so beautiful about everything is that, yes, it has caused conversations and even a divide. It actually, when it first came out, it caused harm in our community, because all of a sudden people are saying, oh, Indigenous people, automatically we were blamed because they thought we were being, you know, it was brought upon by an Indigenous, representative or whatever, right? And then it was like, well, isn't this enough? Then it's about money. And then, and really, it's not about anything except that, well, I think we're using this as an opportunity to learn and come together as a community to honor what we really have created around this culture.
Do you think the board did enough research, consulted with enough Indigenous communities to make this decision?
Oh, no, we know they didn't. We watched the board meetings. We did everything. And I'm actually having a conversation with them because I just, you know, as an Indigenous woman living in this community and active, I'm active in this community with our organization, with community members in the school right now. I'm on actually a locker as an Indigenous trailblazer named after the mascot that I do active work, and the students did that. So, and I'm not taking this time to beef myself up, but we're in a time of healing. Our country needs healing right now. So we're looking at this as an opportunity to look at this and say, enough is enough. That's what the grandma say. Enough is enough. When are we going to really move forward in reconciliation and standing together and making sure our children are taken care of and we're well? So we're all coming together in this community to say, let's hold the board accountable to consultation with the people, consultation with urban Indigenous community members who are in the community and making a difference and trying to build a community for us to actually integrate in, because that's what happened to us. We didn't have a seat at the table, and we never had say. So it was harmful to know that, you know, consultation, they said, happened with one, based off of one anonymous letter, and then only one person led the conversation to say, you need to change that name. And they weren't even, you know, they're not even Haudenosaunee. So it's a challenge that, you know, this is, what's coming out is that it was not a consultation, it wasn't respected. And those are principles of the Truth and Reconciliation. You know, that's built on transparency and, you know, honor and doing things together. And, you know, but we're using it as an opportunity to stand up and try to make things right. And let's hold people accountable to the ethics and code of conduct and being in relationships. And let's do this in a good way, not just sideswiping and then everybody's all up in arms with spending money and, you know, who's doing what. And we're really trying to just heal, because that's the good thing is we're really privileged in this community because we have amazing elders that have been guiding this work because we could, because there was nothing here. There was no Indigenous Friendship Center. There was nothing in the Halston region. So we have really amazing elders who have been, you know, really preserving culture for this time to make change. And I hold that very dear and close to my heart because, you know, we have to believe in something. We have to believe that change has to come. And maybe this is going to bring some, like, an awareness, because everybody knows the word Iroquois. And there's always been this question, what does that mean? Is it derogatory to who? So we're really trying to keep this as a positive opportunity to say, how do we really do this reconciliation in a good way while respecting people's, you know, ways of being and thinking, and it's really about learning right now. A lot of people are learning. Yeah.
Jody Harbour with us, co-founder of Grandmother's Voice, an Indigenous cultural organization in Oakville. Iroquois Ridge Secondary School, set to rename after the Halton District School Board deemed the term Iroquois to be offensive. However, Indigenous elders say they weren't consulted on this, and they believe it pays tribute and creates discussion. Jody, thank you so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thanks.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
There will be a price to pay for it, but it's because they're simply going to be seen to have been in lockstep with the NDP that had a far more radical position. One, by the way, Vashti, that you know, that neither Jack Layton nor I would have ever approved of. But that's been the slow radicalization of the NDP on the Israel-Palestine file. It was very one-sided, what was put forward. I am surprised to learn that Liberals applauded Heather McPherson for that very one-sided approach. But I guess that's going to be part of the rest of the discussion about what happens from now on.
There you have it. Thomas Mulcair yesterday talking about the current state of the NDP party, not his or Jack Layton's, he says. 5:21, let's bring in Larry Deani, former mayor of City of Hamilton. He is here now. Larry, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well, Scott.
What are your thoughts on what Tom Mulcair had to say? And do you think the NDP party is different now than it was under his or Jack Layton's term?
Yes, I think the answer, the short answer is yes for that. I think all parties have shifted. I don't think any party really can be recognized from the traditional way that we used to define the left, the center, and the right. But the NDP, I've noticed that even here in Hamilton, it used to be, especially in Hamilton with its history in the labor movement. The NDP used to be the party of labor, identified itself with the people who worked in the factories, championed their causes, would be on the picket lines with them when appropriate, would advocate for programs and benefits for the labor workers in this city. Right now, that's gone. I think, the last vestige of that was when Scott Duvall left federal politics. Right now, the NDP seems to be more interested in social justice issues rather than the plight of the working person. They're proud of that. You look at the NDP members we have federally here and what they're involved with and what they've contributed to Hamilton, other than animating and organizing and promoting those elements at all levels of government. At the Board of Education, as well as municipal government, and of course, provincially and federally, all of those causes that are embraced by these social warriors as opposed to those who are concerned about making sure that people have good jobs and good pay in those jobs. That's just the way that I see it anyway.
And you bring up a very valid point. They've all gone to the extremes. Do you see that pendulum swinging back? And, you know, first example of that or an example of that, Bonnie Crombie, new provincial Liberal leader, said she's not going to touch the carbon tax. Are we starting to see, and we saw, you know, the prime minister take the great center-left party and move it to the extreme left with the NDP, much like the Wynn Liberals did back in her day and such. Are we seeing this reposition? Are we seeing leaders coming back to the center? Is that what Bonnie Crombie is trying to do, do you think?
Well, I think Bonnie is trying to do that. Whether that takes hold or when it will take hold, I mean, at some point, this pendulum always swings back, right?
Yeah.
But right now, there seems to be a movement globally, not just, I mean, look at what's happening in the States, which is really screwed up. But globally, you're seeing this push to the right, I would say, in many countries, and there seems to be a resurgence of parties that are embracing notions that we used to abhor, that people went to war over in terms of what to support. But that seems to be what is being embraced by the right. And the left as well is pushing back by going even further left. And the middle is being hollowed out. I mean, And ironically, traditionally at least, that's where elections have been won. They've been won when parties sort of champion those causes that span the middle ground. Bonnie, I believe, is certainly trying to bring the provincial Liberal Party to the center. I would say that there are forces in the federal party as well that would love to reoccupy that center, but they've made a deal with the NDP to stay in power. And so consequently, they've had to sort of, you know, dance to their tune because otherwise they would have lost confidence in the House and there would have been an election and so on. And maybe that might have been the better thing to have happened. I don't know. Well, time will tell. But they've certainly positioned themselves on the left of the spectrum, while the conservatives have gone to the right even further than even with Mr. Harper, who was pretty well on the right, but he had to contend with some minority governments as well. So he had to hug the middle more than Paul Yever seems to be willing to do. So, you know, there's been this repositioning in Canada, and at some point, because all governments, you know, they go in with the glowing expectations and promises for Canadians, but then the real politics hits them and they have to deal with the real issues of the day. What are people concerned about? And they're concerned about jobs, and they're concerned about expenditures, and they're concerned about cost of living, and they're concerned about inflation. And so governments will make mistakes, and then there's a repositioning at that point as well. We may see it, and we've actually seen it in terms of attitudes, right? Look at Mr. Mulroney. He left power and reduced his party to two seats. Now, Kim Campbell took the fall for that. But really, that election was all about voting against Brian Mulroney. And now, God bless him and may he rest in peace, he's a hero, and for good reasons as well. He did do some unpopular but transformational things for the country, both economically and championing some environmental causes and apartheid and so on. So he's being given his just reward posthumously, unfortunately. But he is doing that. And at some point, you know, all of these things sort of even out and people will, with the arc of history, will assess things a little differently than they do in the heat of the moment.
Larry Deani with us, former mayor of City of Hamilton, talking federal politics. Larry, I could do this for an hour. Thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. All the best.
A conservative motion to spike the hike and stop the April 1st carbon tax increase was defeated in the House of Commons today. The motion ultimately defeated with the Liberals, the NDP, and the Bloc all voting against it. It now appears that Polyev will introduce a non-confidence motion in the government over the increase, and I'm not sure how much more successful that's going to be. Either way, let's bring in Franco Terrazano, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director, and here now. Franco, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me on today.
This seems to be getting a tremendous amount of attention, Franco, but it doesn't look like the governing party is going to budge on this. Your thoughts?
Well, that's to their own peril. That's to their own peril. Like, I'm glad this is getting a lot of attention, and it rightly should be. I mean, Canadians are already struggling. I don't need to tell you this, but with the cost of, it seems like, everything being so high for so long, the absolute last thing the federal government should be doing under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is making everything more expensive with another carbon tax hike on April the 1st. So it's only like a week and a bit away, right? And here's the thing. Let me just talk about this vote in the House of Commons today. It was a motion to cancel the April 1 carbon tax increase. Now, the Conservatives brought that motion in. The Conservative MPs voted in favor of carbon tax relief, but it died. Like, let's just be honest here, because of Liberal and NDP members of Parliament. They voted to hike the carbon tax, and they voted to increase the cost of necessities for Canadians, like heating our homes, like driving to work, and like every time we have to go to the grocery store. So the reason that that motion died, like, we knew the Bloc was going to vote against it. Quebec doesn't pay a federal carbon tax. So the reason that the motion died is because Liberal and NDP MPs decided to stand with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau instead of standing up with Canadians who are already stretched far too thin.
They're quick to say, Franco, but you know, when this goes up April 1st, so does your check.
Oh, yeah, I mean, they're using magic math, right? It's because they're not actually looking at all the costs, right? And the carbon tax, it doesn't just impact the fuel you get, right? It doesn't just make gas prices more expensive. It doesn't just make natural gas more expensive. The carbon tax costs trickle throughout the entire economy. Let's just look at one quick example, the price of food. Well, the carbon tax on Canadian farm fuels will cost Canadian farmers $1 billion by 2030. Now, the carbon tax is also on diesel. So that means that the carbon tax makes it more expensive for farmers to grow food, and it means that it makes it more expensive for truckers to deliver the food. And it also makes it more expensive for store owners to heat those stores. So that's just one quick example of how the carbon tax makes it more expensive for Canadians every time we go to the store, and how the carbon tax trickles across the entire economy. And in fact, the PBO has crunched the numbers. The Parliamentary Budget Officer looked at all the costs and all the benefits from the rebate, and the PBO shows that the carbon tax will cost the average family in Ontario $600 more a year than what they get back in rebates.
You know, you'll sit and watch the House of Commons go back and forth, and they'll argue. One will say this is the number, the other one will say that is the number, and they're it's amazing. It's as if the other one doesn't listen to what the other person is saying. One of the other, ways the Liberals are selling this is that it's a communications problem. You don't understand it. We don't understand how this works. We don't understand how this benefits us. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, that really, I feel like, just insults Canadians' intelligence, as if they think that Canadians don't understand their own financial situations as good as Liberal MPs do, right? But the problem is, like, look, I'm not saying Trudeau has great communications. I think they have sloppy communications. I think everyone does. But the real problem is not a communications problem. They have a carbon tax is making people's lives more expensive problem. That's the fundamental issue here, right? And even take away all the numbers, which, by the way, are published in the PBO report that they recently put out, or their most recent report, just on page 9. But look, take away the data and just ask yourself, how in the world can a government put in a carbon tax, then charge its sales tax on top of the carbon tax, and then skim hundreds of millions of dollars off the top to pay for the bureaucracy to administer the carbon tax, and then somehow make everyone better off with rebates? It's impossible. And Canadians know it's impossible. And that's why the vast majority of Canadians in every province and in every demographic are against the upcoming carbon tax hike.
If they were to pause this, like many are asking for, or even do what they did with the rest of Canada, that they did with Atlantic Canada, obviously we'd feel relief. We'd feel relieved. Would this help in any way? Do you think they would help the party move forward?
Well, I think they have no choice if they don't want to fall even further into the political debt. You know what I mean? And what's so crazy about this is that outside of Ottawa, outside the House of Commons, opposition to the carbon tax hike is completely nonpartisan, right? You have Liberals, NDP, you have conservative MLAs across provincial legislatures opposing the carbon tax hike. I mean, you even have the lone Liberal provincial premier in Newfoundland and Labrador calling out Trudeau publicly to not raise the carbon tax on April 1. I mean, now you have Bonnie Crombie, right? The leader of the Ontario Liberal Party saying that she won't put in a carbon tax in Ontario. You also have the former BC Liberal Party who first brought in the carbon tax out there that are also against future hikes. And, you know, I'm from Alberta and I can't believe I'm seeing this, but you even have NDP leadership hopefuls in Alberta saying the carbon tax is dead. So outside of Ottawa, opposition to the upcoming carbon tax hike is multi-partisan. And the reason that is because they're listening to Canadians who can't afford another hike. Now it's time for NDP members of parliament and Liberal MPs to also listen to Canadians and to finally stand up against the prime minister.
Are you surprised that they keep selling that this is helping the environment? It's bringing down. I mean, I heard an MP say this the other day, that it's bringing down emissions when in fact it's not bringing down Canada's emission. And the parliamentary budget officer said so. How can you keep selling something that, I don't know, where's the evidence?
Well, that's the exact question. Where's the evidence? Because it's costing us an arm and a leg, and they can't show that it's bringing down emissions, right? And in fact, the parliamentary budget officer says that, you know, Canada's emissions aren't even large enough to materially impact climate change. Mm-hmm. We make up 1.5% of global emissions. Like, even U.S. Democrat President Joe Biden, he doesn't have a national carbon tax. You know what I mean? So all that this is doing is making it more expensive for people to fuel up their sedans, making it more expensive for people to heat their homes, making it more expensive for people to put food on their family's table. And it's not an environmental plan. It's not doing anything like that. Like, that is one of the big issues here. But of course, the Liberal Party, they're seeing their polls absolutely plummeting, and their backs are against the walls here, just grasping for straws.
Franco Terrazano with us, Canadian Taxpayers Federation federal director. The campaign to pause the or cut or anything to the April 1st carbon tax increase in full swing. Franco, thanks for the time. Be well.
Hey, thank you for having me on today.
Rodley coming in after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is with us now. Scott, I hope you're having a great day.
Could not. Well, yeah, fine. Good. Could not be better, I was going to say, but it is spring, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we didn't get much of a winter, so they're trying to cram it all into the last edge of winter, I guess. This is the first full day of spring, so yeah, who knows? All right. So I want to play you a clip from Thomas Mulcair. I don't know if you heard that but listen carefully as he describes the current NDP and how it's not the one he represented, or even Jack Layton, for that matter.
Okay.
Here we go.
There will be a price to pay for it, but it's because they're simply going to be seen to have been in lockstep with the NDP that had a far more radical position. One, by the way, Vashti, that you know, that neither Jack Layton nor I would have ever approved of. But that's been the slow radicalization of the NDP on the Israel-Palestine file. It was very one-sided, what was put forward. I am surprised to learn that Liberals applauded Heather McPherson for that very one-sided approach. But I guess that's going to be part of the rest of the discussion about what happens from now on.
All right. The news story, the vote yesterday, the NDP put forth a motion to recognize a Palestinian state. After many hours of debate, it was eventually watered down, and they now will actively pursue a two-state solution with a Palestinian state, which is really kind of where we are before all this started. What are your thoughts? Because, man, this just divides.
So we're going to be talking in the second hour today to the head of the Hamilton Jewish Federation, the one who had their film festival canceled here in Hamilton.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has been in the news all day. And, you know, I got to expect that this, along with so many other things that are going on right now, I'm not Jewish. But if I was a Jewish person, and I don't want to like presume to speak for Jewish people, but if I was a Jewish person with all this going on with this and with what's happening in Ottawa and all, I just more and more do not feel at all like many of the people who are running things in this country really want me here. And not to be overstating it, but if you're in your own House of Commons of your country and there are numbers of people who will, of course, say, well, we're not supporting Hamas, but they're certainly not supporting you. And the whole reason this war is happening, there was no war before Hamas decided on October the 6th, the 7th, to do what they did.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't say I don't understand. I mean, I sort of understand because, you know, this is not exactly a new thing that Jewish people have found themselves being disliked or far, far worse over the years. I mean, as I say, it's not a new thing. And I use disliked as the lowest of the bar there. But I don't really understand. Israel has been an ally. Hamas is on our official terrorist group, official Canadian list.
Yeah.
And somehow now we're tipping toward, and they are the government, and we're tipping towards them, it seems, in some cases. You know, Scott, I think you or someone the other day talked about, you know, the world is upside down. The world is upside down.
You know, I've asked the question since this started way back when to any expert that'll come on the show, what do Palestinians need to do to separate themselves from Hamas? Why haven't other countries in the Middle East helped them out? Where is Egypt? Where is Jordan? And the reason is they're scared of Hamas. So how come we're on this side of the pond? All we talk about is Palestinians and Israelis, and we seem to forget that the Palestinian people are being represented. Their government is a terrorist organization. We don't seem to talk about that or understand that. We certainly see the killing and my God, the tragedy of war. My mother lived through the war. She lost four relatives. But we seem to be losing that this is a war between democracy and Hamas. And where do Palestinians fall in that as Hamas is their ruler?
So I'm not suggesting that it's not complicated, because if your government, if the people who are governing you are the people like Hamas, and we saw what they did, and frankly, by the way, there are some people out there who are still being denialists about what happened on October 6th and 7th, which is just insanity. But anyway, we saw what those particular people, that group, is capable of. It's unthinkable. I understand that it is a very complicated situation and very difficult for those who are living under that regime. It's not like you can simply have a free vote. When was the last vote that Hamas had that was a free vote to not have them govern? However, that said, there were polls done that showed a large number of people there supported those things. Again, it gets into very complicated things. And so, you know, again, these are very complex things, but the idea that you, if you're Israel, are supposed to not prevent this from happening again. Is war nice? Nobody wants to have a war. Nobody likes seeing what's happening in Palestine or Gaza. But is Israel supposed to just allow this to happen again? Or like the states after 9/11, when they said, we are going after Al-Qaeda, are you permitted to try and root out and get rid of the group that did this? And you know, the whole thing, to me, if I was a Jewish person, and again, I'm not, but I want to be very, I don't know how, if you're a Jewish person in this country, you are not feeling like you are being ostracized again and again and again, and you are being treated very, very, very poorly. We're talking about this in the first hour, sort of, today, but I don't get how, if you're a Jewish person, you're not looking at this and saying, my country and many of the people who run my country really don't have my back at all.
Well said. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great show, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, greatly appreciated. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, for the last word. This via email, Sim says, first day of spring and we have snow. Maybe it's the planets correctly aligning and giving the Prime Minister the weather he is looking for to take that long walk. Go get him, sir. Keep right, except a pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.